From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The House of Representatives is set to vote today on a stopgap measure to keep the government open past tomorrow. But big questions remain about whether that will pass. President Trump told reporters today that a shutdown very well could happen.
And the worst thing is for our military. We don't want that to happen. I'm here to support our military.
He was speaking at the Pentagon. Many are also worried that, shutdown or not, nothing will be done at the moment when it comes to the 800,000 people protected from deportation by the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA. For more on that, we're joined by Todd Schulte, who's president of Forward.us, an immigration advocacy group backed by leaders in the tech industry, including Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg. Todd, are you holding out any hope for a DACA deal as part of the spending bill negotiations?
You know, we are really optimistic. And the reason for that is, you know, it's not just 85% of Americans who think Congress should act now to protect dreamers, but it's 79% of Republicans. This has incredible bipartisan support. You know, there's a lot of jockeying on both sides of the aisle here. But the one thing that I think everyone agrees needs to happen, and that could happen if both parties are willing to get together and work on this, is, you know, both a long-term spending package, but one, quite frankly, that ensures we're not going to be deporting hundreds of thousands of DACA recipients. That'd be terrible.
And yet it doesn't look like DACA is going to be in this bill, does it? I mean, the rhetoric coming out sounds like they're going to push that off to a later time, and there's very little time left.
There is very little time left. This really needs to get done right now. You actually had three bipartisan former secretaries of the Department of Homeland Security say, actually, January 19th is the real deadline to get this done. You know, there's always people who will tell you, oh, we're with you, but we'll get to it later. We've kind of come to the end here. Every day that we wait is going to be hundreds and thousands pretty soon, dreamers who are going to be subject to deportation.
So how do you think this fell apart? If it did fall apart, how did it fall apart?
You know, in Washington, there's never a deal until the last minute, which is both terrible and kind of just how it is here. I think the fundamentals still remain. The overwhelming number of the American public want to get this done. And I think what you're seeing is, you know, folks like conservative senator from South Dakota, Mike Rounds, say, hold on a second, there's a good bipartisan package. I support that. You know, and so I think the opportunity to get this done is right now. And real lives are on the line every day that we wait here, and Congress fiddles.
Do you think President Trump is on the same page as you about the Dreamers?
I think it's fair to say that President Trump created this crisis by ending DACA. I think at times he has clearly shown that he does not want to be responsible for that and wants a deal. I also think you need to be really clear. There are people around the president who, number one, wanted to end DACA so that they could do what they're trying to do now, which is slash legal immigration. The president has the opportunity to make big improvements in terms of funding for border security and take care of these young people. He said he wants to do that. But he can't listen to the people who want to slash legal immigration in exchange for that. And so, you know, really, ultimately, at the end of the day, he is the biggest actor here, and this is on him. He created this crisis, and he has the biggest opportunity to fix it.
What would you say if the deal was, we'll protect the Dreamers, but there's also going to have to be a border wall? Is that a good deal?
I mean, I think the border wall gets talked about a lot. Is it going to? We're never, ever, ever going to have a 1,000-mile border wall, right? I mean, that's $80 billion. It's never going to happen. I think the deal is going to include money for improvements in border security. And I think some of that's going to be physical barriers. Some of that may be walls in places here. I also think it's important to understand, though, that's actually not what's really holding up this deal. What's holding up a deal is people who claim to say it's about border security, but really are trying to hold hostage these 800,000 young people in exchange for cutting the legal immigration system in half. I mean, that's what Tom Cotton wants. He's a senator. That's what folks like Jeff Sessions want. They are part of maybe the 10 or the 12% of this country who also wants to deport Dreamers. And the president's not going to be able to listen to them if he wants to get this big deal done. And, you know, this is the end of the first year of his presidency. This is a unique opportunity to get this done. And if we don't get this done, the consequences are going to be absolutely devastating.
So if DACA is tomorrow not part of the deal, what do you do next?
We think it's absolutely critical it does get done. But if you saw some sort of like 72-hour extension, which I think is possible here, the urgency doesn't go away. I mean, we have 122 DACA recipients every day falling out of status. On March 5th, that skyrockets to 1,400 DACA recipients every single day. this is going to be something that, until this is resolved, people are going to be fighting incredibly hard. Republicans, Democrats, independents, business owners, Dreamers, all lined up to say we have to get this done right now. Every day that there's a delay, there are horrible, horrible consequences.
That's Todd Schulte, who is the president of the group Forward.us, also former chief of staff at the Obama Super PAC Priorities USA Action. Todd, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That's the sound of North Korea's Moranbang Band, one of the most popular bands in that country. We'll post a clip at herenow.org. And we now know that another North Korean band, Somjiang, will perform at the Olympics next month, along with North Korean cheerleaders, and that athletes from the North and the South will march together in the opening ceremony, train together at a North Korean ski resort, and compete together on a joint women's hockey team, a huge breakthrough in diplomacy. The Koreas have marched together before in Sydney in 2000, Athens in 2004, Italy in 2006, but at least one other attempt to unite through sports failed disastrously. The two Koreas were going to try to share the 1988 Seoul Olympics after the South won the Games, but after those talks collapsed, the North bombed a South Korean passenger jet, killing over 100 on board to try to disrupt the Games. Jean Lee is a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Seoul. As a journalist, she opened the AP's first bureau in North Korea in 2012. She joins us now by Skype. Jean, your thoughts about this sports detente we're hearing about?
Well, it's all happening so fast, so it's a little overwhelming. Because we had provocations from North Korea until fairly recently, I can tell you that it's certainly welcome news for South Koreans. I can't say that they're dancing in the streets. They've been down this path before. But certainly, I can tell you that South Koreans want to have peace rather than nuclear war.
Well, when you say this thing has happened before, very successfully, they fielded a table tennis team at the World Championships in 1991. But then there's just that disaster from 1987 when, the North actually bombed a jet to try to disrupt the Games when talks failed. Is there some nervousness that if this doesn't work in the next few weeks, it could go in the other direction?
North Korea does have a pattern in the history of state-sponsored terrorism. It was taken off the U.S. list of state-sponsored terrorism some years ago, but they are back on that list. Remember that it was last year, exactly a year ago, that the half-brother of the current leader of North Korea was assassinated in that airport in Malaysia. So that's always a consideration.
Right.
But this time around, I think South Koreans are fairly sure that having North Korean athletes and such a big contingent of North Koreans at the Olympics is, in a sense, a security assurance or insurance against some sort of provocation.
But they have to sort of walk a very tender line. We're thinking of the first meeting that the two countries had this time around, and it was all joking and everything. And then when the South brought up the North's nuclear program, I love the quote from North Korea's lead delegate. He said, "We started in good spirit, but this came to an icky mood. They didn't want anyone to talk to them about their missile program." So talk a little bit about what this is doing to the ongoing concern about the North's missile program. Does this sort of sideline U.S. attempts at tempering that?
This detente between North and South Korea, this bilateral discussion on improving relations, certainly has the U.S. nervous, because the U.S. is leading this campaign to really put the pinch on North Korea and try to get them back to the negotiating table. So the South Korean foreign minister just sat down and was photographed huddling with the Secretary of State of the United States, Rex Tillerson. And I think that picture was meant to send a very strong image to the North Koreans, that they are on the same page, that they're working closely, and that there's no daylight between them.
Look, just one last thought about these images that we're seeing. We're hearing these bands, and we'll have videos at herenow.org. They are spectacular. We're hearing about the South's ski team is going to be going to the North, to a resort in the North, to practice together. For a lot of Americans, that's shocking. They didn't know North Korea had a ski resort or these huge bands. It doesn't jive with the image that we're getting from the administration of just crazy leadership and starving people. Is it all for show?
Frankly, sending such a huge contingent of performers to the Olympics as a propaganda coup for Pyongyang. These performers are meant to project a certain image, an image of unity and synchronicity, because they are very coordinated, but also they send their most beautiful women. So they are meant to seduce the public. In terms of the ski resort, you know, I did go to the ski resort a couple weeks after it opened in 2014, and I have to say, it is shocking. You drive from Pyongyang through this really underdeveloped region, just barren, and then this ski resort just rises like the city of Oz before you. Mm. And I did say, and back then when he did open the ski resort, that this, he had this Olympics in mind. He has been planning for this since 2011, when South Korea won the bid, and has been thinking, how can I make sure that North Korea is at the center of this spotlight, even if South Korea has won the right to host that Winter Olympics?
Well, he figured it out. Jean Lee, a journalist, global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center, also head of the AP Bureau in Pyongyang in the north. Jean, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, Morin Bong, reportedly Kim Jong-un's favorite band. It's huge. Videos at hearnow.org.
The kangaroo is the national symbol of Australia. Its image is on the rudders of Qantas Airlines, on signs. Stuffed kangaroos are sold in gift shops. That doesn't mean that Australia loves its kangaroos. According to the new documentary, Kangaroo, A Love-Hate Story, many Australians consider kangaroos to be a pest. Thousands are shot and killed every night. Kangaroo, A Love-Hate Story opens in theaters starting tomorrow, and joining us now are the filmmakers Kate McIntyre Clare and Mick McIntyre. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
And we think today of kangaroos as really a symbol of Australia. Are they only found there?
Yeah, pretty much. There's about 70 species of kangaroo, and most of them are from Australia. There's a couple in Papua New Guinea and in the highlands and stuff. But yeah, they're an indigenous species that's been in Australia for something like 25 million years.
Hmm. And when did they start to be hunted there?
Well, the indigenous Australians, the Aborigines, have been hunting them for as long as they've been on the continent, which is something like 50,000 years. So sustainably, they've been hunted by Aborigines. White settlement over 250 years ago is when they started to be exploited in a different way by the white settlers when they landed from England.
Just killing a lot more of them?
Yeah, just killing a lot more of them. And that was when it was first decided that they were competing for agriculture, and they were competing for what the white settlers wanted to do with the land.
Well, we hear in your documentary from an Australian farmer, Stephen Tully, about how kangaroos impact what he does. Let's listen.
We have too many kangaroos. Our sheep and cattle are competing directly with kangaroos for that pasture. It's a balance of what balance we have to turn that pasture into protein. We estimate we've got between 20 and 30,000 kangaroos here. So from the environment's point of view, from my point of view, at the moment, they are a pest.
They are a pest. There are a lot of people here who talk about kangaroos as a pest. Why are they saying that, and why is that so important?
When white settlement first started, it was a very Western idea that agriculture came first and anything that got in its way was a problem or a pest. So I think it started off on the bad foot, so to speak, and in the past 250 years, as Australia has become much more of an agricultural society, that issue has become even more prevalent.
Does the fact that they are considered pests by some impact the way that they're treated?
Oh, totally, of course. Whenever we call something a pest, it means that we can destroy it pretty much in any way we want. We can be incredibly inhumane about that. So, yes, some people consider them pests, and that's in a way how the media has portrayed them. They're iconic in that we wave flags at the Olympics with kangaroos on it, and all our major sports teams are named something to do with a kangaroo. So we kind of love the idea of them. But I think, you know, historically we've found them to be in our way for development. That's probably like the most rounded idea. If it's in your way, just get it out of the way, kill it, remove it.
And that brings us to one of the most disturbing parts about this film, which is you've got video of kangaroos being shot, left to die, you know, in parts of Australia, very painful death, having their babies pulled out of them and then beaten to death, basically.
that's the other side to what Kate just said, that the love-hate story, that there's this consideration that they are to be gotten rid of. And because Australia is a large country and because these killings are done in the bush at night, you know, out of sight basically, it means that there's more opportunity for these animals to be killed in inhumane ways.
Let's listen to another clip from the film. This is a former roo shooter, somebody who shot kangaroos. Here she is.
I did it for about 3 years full-time and 2 years part-time, and I found that to be terribly emotionally traumatic. The last thought at night is something about even a roo laying there in pain. I can't go to sleep for the night because of the stress the roo industry has caused me.
Why are some of these kangaroos treated so badly, even by people who just want to shoot them to, you know, sell the meat or sell parts of the body?
What the government response is and what the industry response is that there is a code of practice that they follow in the killing of the kangaroos, but this code of practice isn't always followed. And as I said earlier, because it's done out of sight and out of public eyes, it's very easy for people to not follow this code of practice.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about a new film called Kangaroo, A Love-Hate Story. We're speaking with the filmmakers, Kate McIntyre-Claire and Mick McIntyre. And let me ask you, we haven't talked about the exact number of kangaroos in Australia, and there's a reason for that, as you point out in your film. It's not easy to know exactly what that number is, which is part of the problem.
Yeah, look, people want to know the number all the time, and they're a wild species, you know, and we've got a big country, and there is some data being collected, but many scientists disagree with the method they're using still, that we've been using that method for 50 years, the same method, and we feel like a national discussion isn't being had around things like the numbers, the reasoning, the dignity around the kangaroo's right to be there. There's a whole lot of scientists at odds that are not allowed to sort of talk to each other or aren't being brought together for a national discussion.
What we found, as you mentioned in your question, that we found the methodology used to count these kangaroos, it seems to be quite flawed. Mm-hmm. That's the discussion we need to be having. If the methodology used to count the kangaroos is flawed, then clearly there's a problem, and what we also heard from some scientists is that there is regional extinction happening. And so, yeah, it's ludicrous, the numbers that are being bandied across the media by the government and by the industry, because it was not our experience in making this film that those numbers are what are being bandied around.
What is the demand like? You know, you talk about it being used as pet food in the early days, also for meat that humans buy at the supermarket and then cook in Australia. We also hear about kangaroos being used to make shoes, to make soccer cleats as well. What kind of things are people using this for, and how widespread is the demand?
Well, right here in America, there's kangaroo products in every state except for California, where it's banned. They're made for soccer cleats, they're made for pet food, they're made for clothing, car seats, the soft leathers used, shoes, you know. So America is the second largest importer of kangaroo products in the world. A lot of the industry in Australia is in export for all those things. So it's sort of like cutting down the old growth forest, really, to make, you know, matches.
Well, and you mentioned California. You point out in this film that the Australian government has been lobbying California to allow kangaroo products to be sold there, but unsuccessfully so far.
Yeah, and as Kate said, but that still doesn't stop America being the second largest importer of kangaroo products. And I think the other important thing to remember is that this is a wildlife species. These animals are not farmed. So when you put a price on wildlife, when you exploit a wildlife commercially, we look back through history, what happens to that wildlife, and the wildlife usually lose.
Now, you said the U.S. is the second largest importer. What's the largest?
Europe.
Okay. Yeah. And as you point out, thank goodness China is not interested yet in kangaroo meat.
But it's interesting because what we found about in the film and we heard from government is that the government is lobbying China to include kangaroo on their free trade agreement. So it's clearly something that the Australian government is interested in doing, is opening up a market for kangaroo meat into China.
So how optimistic are you about the fate of the kangaroo in Australia?
Well, I think making Kangaroo the movie, at first we just wanted to celebrate the kangaroo. And once we kind of unpack that it's so divided and complicated within the Australian community, we thought the very least we can do is to start a national conversation about what to do next. And in some ways, I feel we've never had that conversation. And you need national discussions on things that you haven't talked about for a while just to sort of decide, what are we doing now? Is this okay? And where do we move forward?
My anecdotal experience is we were very lucky, and for people who get to see the film, hopefully you'll appreciate the effort we've gone to filming The Magnificent Animal. But the footage that you do see are these amazing animals that stand over 2 metres tall, you know, one of the most magnificent wildlife experiences you can imagine. We're in national parks where, of course, they're protected. But to counter that, when we filmed out in outback Queensland and outback New South Wales, I was really shocked to not find the same healthy populations and certainly not find the large animals that I'd seen in the national park. In fact, some of the farmers had promised to, you know, that I could film the plagues that we keep hearing about. And alas, I was never shown plagues and we could never find plagues. It quickly dawned on me that this is a term that they use to advantage their cause of considering them a pest. And so my anecdotal evidence was that, yeah, I could see that the numbers of the animals left are smaller. And as a parent, I started to think about the future of this animal, and I started to think about what if we don't have this discussion that Kate was talking about, and in 10 years' time we look back and go, oh, wow, we could have done something about this, or we could have had the discussion. So I guess as a storyteller, as a filmmaker, we really feel that our film is going to create a discussion that needs to be had about the future of the kangaroo.
That's Mick McIntyre and Kate McIntyre-Claire. Their film Kangaroo, A Love-Hate Story opens in theaters beginning tomorrow. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thanks so much,
Thanks
Jeremy.
So much.
And you can see a trailer and find out where to see the film at hereandnow.org.
This podcast and following message sponsored by WBUR.
Hi, I'm Ben Brock Johnson, here to introduce you to Endless Thread, a new podcast from WBUR and Reddit featuring stories that capture the internet's endless permutations of human potential.
Even though it's like this huge network with millions of users, you know, there's still that kind of like small world connection there.
Endless Thread, supported by ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire, and by Wistia, where videos get put to work. Learn more at wbur.org/endlessthread and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
What's wrong with Tom Brady's hand? Oh, sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. Sunday's NFL Conference Championship games will determine the teams that play in Super Bowl 52 on February 4th in Minneapolis. In the AFC, the New England Patriots, led by Tom Brady's hand, will host the Jacksonville Jaguars. And in the NFC, the Minnesota Vikings will play the Eagles in Philadelphia. Mike Pesca is here now as a sports analyst, the host of the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, is something wrong with Tom Brady's hand?
Robin, how dare you ask about Tom Brady's hand? That was the hand that led them over and over to the promised land. And it is his heart, not his hand. But in all seriousness, it doesn't seem the Patriots have this tendency to list everything on their injury report. And that is a little obfuscatory because in a sense, you list nothing. There was a portion where the media got to see Tom Brady throw on Wednesday and they said he looked fine. But they did say that his hand was injured. They didn't get into too many specifics. You need something to worry about. That's just as good a thing as anything else.
Well, they're saying everything's fine. But the Patriots are favored. They're playing at home. The Jaguars went into Pittsburgh last weekend and beat the favored Steelers. What do you see here?
The Steelers, I fault the Steelers and the Steelers' game plan. They allowed a pretty underperforming Jacksonville team up until that point to put up a lot of points on them. And the knock against Jacksonville, they do have an excellent defense, and they have excellent defensive line, which means that Tom Brady will be under a lot of pressure, and that's not a position he or any other quarterback likes. So that is true. But the huge knock, and it's accurate, against Jacksonville is they have a pretty pathetic quarterback, Blake Bortles. Among starters, I would say he's one of the worst. Yet he looked great against Pittsburgh. Why? I think Pittsburgh let him beat him with kind of simple throws. And even though the Patriots have statistically one of the worst defenses in the NFL, they're not stupid. And so I think that they'll put together a game plan that will bottle up Bortles, if you will.
It's a new bumper sticker. We're not stupid. Okay.
We're not stupid, and the hand is fine.
Over in the NFC, the Vikings beat the Saints on that miracle play, that last-second touchdown pass. Beautiful. What do you think we should watch as the Vikings now meet the Eagles on Sunday?
Yes. So 2 weeks in a row, the Eagles will be underdogs. The Eagles beat the Falcons last week. And that's because they played a brand of football that adheres to their strengths. For most of the season, they were an excellent passing team because they had an excellent quarterback, Carson Wentz. He got hurt. Now the replacement, Nick Foles, is under center. He has limitations. So the coach of the Eagles, Doug Peterson, is working around their limitations. He's allowing Foles to run a little bit or to see what the defense gives him or to occasionally hand it off. He's doing a great job in making Foles the best quarterback he could be. The Eagles are still the underdog against Minnesota. Minnesota has a great defense. It is an odd situation where the team that had the number one seed in the NFC has been underdogs both weeks. But the reason that they're underdogs is that the Vikings have a great defense, a good enough offense, as we saw with that amazing play against the Saints. And they're built for the outdoors. They play indoors in Minnesota, where the Super Bowl is going to be. But they can be a good outdoor team. So that's why a lot of the people who make the odds say that Minnesota should win. They were wrong last week. Let's see about this week.
Okay. Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist. What do you think?
Oh, I think Minnesota will win and be the first team to host a Super Bowl.
All right. By the way, Mike's also author of the upcoming book, Upon. Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. I just saw that. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
Maybe you saw the image this past Martin Luther King Day. Maybe you saw it last MLK Day. It went viral both times. It's an illustration of two well-known men. On the right, Dr. Martin Luther King, one dark finger pressed to his lips, a shush, his other hand extended and covering the mouth of a tweeting, red-capped Donald Trump. It's called My Brother's Keeper. It's the work of 31-year-old Philadelphia-based artist Watson Meer. And it took on even more power for many this week because Watson is the son of Haitian immigrants. And MLK Day came just after the president reportedly said, "Why do we need more Haitians? Take them out," in that closed-door meeting with lawmakers, grouping the country with African nations with a vulgar phrase. We had wanted to talk to Watson about his work, which he makes on his computer using Microsoft Paint and a mouse. And his life, he didn't speak until he was 4 years old, and his teachers taught him how to draw, gave him some of the computer tools so that he could express himself. Gradually, he found his voice and his art. But now seemed like a good moment to call him up. Watson Meer joins us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So the White House didn't deny those comments the day they were reported. This week, the president said he wants immigrants from everywhere. Your thoughts when you heard those words reported and saw your piece go viral again?
Well, when I first heard the words reported, I initially was very disheartened, especially since it was around the anniversary of the earthquake of 2010 that hit Haiti. And around that time of the year, that's usually a time where Haitians around the world, millions, we grieve and we remembered the lost ones that were killed because of the earthquake.
Almost 300,000 Haitians died.
Yes, an unimaginable number.
Yeah.
just seeing the images and my relatives that were in Haiti, just hearing their accounts of like how horrific it was and loved ones that they actually lost. Usually that's a time where Haitians, we grieve. It happened about 8 years ago now, but it's still something that hits us all really deeply around that time of the year. So yeah. That combined with the alleged remarks, I tend to not try to allow anything that the news or he says affect me, but that really hit somewhere deep.
Well, and people began responding. Columnist Renee Graham wrote about people of color jumping onto social media to talk about how skilled they are. You know, a woman from Sudan writes, "I have 3 degrees. I speak 3 languages. I'm published." Another man wrote, "I went to war. I have a Purple Heart." How did you feel like responding? You know, did you feel like responding?
It was more so, I wouldn't consider Haiti that, first of all. Haiti is an extremely beautiful country with some of the most beautiful, most creative, most vibrant people in the world that you'll ever meet. Haiti has contributed so much to the America, U.S. history. Because of the Haitian Revolution, America was able to purchase the Louisiana Territory from the French. Like cities like Chicago was actually founded by a Haitian. So Haitian contribution to this country is plenty, and so I just couldn't imagine that someone could say something about a country that has like just contributed so much to the world. So.
Yeah. Well, and just to finish the thought with Renee Graham, she went on to say, this idea of feeling that you have to defend yourself, it's called respectability politics before that uplift suasion. You know, people of color feeling if I just point out that I can behave in a certain way, whites will like me, you know. Renee says that's beneath people of color. We shouldn't have to, you know, defend who we are. Mm. But you also have another outlet, which is, you know, your artwork. What did you feel when you saw your piece go viral again, Martin Luther King and Donald Trump?
To be completely honest with you, it was surreal. I wasn't really expecting that at all. I released it last year, mainly because I just wanted to do something in honor of Dr. King. And it just so happened that Martin Luther King Day was a week before the inauguration, and the atmosphere and of the entire country. My spirit just gave me the vision of the image that I ultimately created. But in terms of it actually going viral once again, that was just something that was I didn't imagine, and it really caught me by surprise.
Yeah. Well, you say your spirit moved you. To say what? Martin Luther King, it's very gentle. You know, he's gently shushing Donald Trump.
Yes, because of what I know of the history and the legacy of Dr. King, his message of equality, peaceful equality. So I didn't want to do anything that was too aggressive. I didn't want to do anything that was a caricature of either one of them. I wanted to just do something that would be completely honest and real. And that's why the piece is called My Brother's Keeper. It's not, I just wanted to take on his spirit of just saying, you know, giving out that message of equality that Dr. King, that he embedded in all of us to possibly have that leadership lead Trump into, you know, with the messages that he has been given, I don't feel like they've been in line with Dr. King's message of equality.
Donald Trump is tweeting in that picture something about leadership, maybe.
True. I would say so.
Well, we talked about this idea of having to defend yourself and defend the Haitian people and try to be, as Renee Graham pointed out, you know, more white, you know, so to be accepted by whites. You seem to go the other way in your work. You celebrate your blackness.
Yes.
Big hair, African features. Then we'll have posted it here in now.org. I have it embedded in my head, you know, women with hair piled 4 feet high. What are you saying?
Basically what I'm saying is that it's okay to embrace yourself. It's okay to, and not even if you're African-American, but whoever you are, it's okay to embrace whoever you are. To me, it doesn't make sense to try to like alter who you are just to be quote unquote professional. You can be professional and at the same time like embrace your roots. So I basically just wanted to create images because I remember going to a museum. It was beautiful art in the museum. I loved it, but I didn't see anything that represented me or my culture. Like so, I rather than complain about it, I said, you know what, I have a skill that God's blessed me with. Why not go out there and create the art that I wanted to see, and also like just show people that it's okay to be yourself. Okay to like embrace yourself.
It's not just museums. You're working on a piece called Google Search Beauty, and we did.
Yes.
And if you Google search the word beauty, well, what'd you find?
You know, that's actually something. Yeah, exactly. Well, when I Google searched the word beauty, there were beautiful images of beautiful women, but it wasn't like it wasn't as diverse as I thought it could possibly be. So I said, you know what, I'm gonna diversify it a little bit and have an African American woman, you know, having her hair out and just embracing herself and letting her know that that's beautiful as well. No matter what your race is, no matter what your whatever your body form, like you're beautiful and you're just in your natural self.
Talk about the influence of Basquiat, the Brooklyn graffiti artist who rose to huge fame before an early death. His symbol was a crown. Yes. Yours looks something like his, your symbol on your website. And you celebrate him in one of your pieces. You've got the Basquiat crown there that used to be his graffiti. And what are the letters? Same old.
S-A-M-O.
S-A-M-O, yep, same old. Mm-hmm. And a picture of a young man. What's his influence on you? What does that crown mean to you?
Basquiat has been a huge influence on me. I remember as a kid in high school, just researching, like, you know, famous black artists and, like, finding Basquiat and just discovering his work for the first time. And then also discovering that he's actually of Haitian descent. He's Haitian and Puerto Rican. Similar to me, he grew up in very, you know, he grew up in an environment with not much opportunity, but he was able to create something out of nothing. And he's not only an influence to me, but in terms of many black artists, he's a huge influence. Because he's someone that currently right now he's in the ranks of a Picasso, of a Matisse, of a Van Gogh, and he's like a modern black artist who grew up exactly like a lot of black artists grew up now. Now he's in the ranks with legends.
Yeah, he's in the pantheon. Is that crown to you? Is that the hair of the women?
Yes, yes, that's a perfect way of stating it right there. You hit it on the head.
In one of the images, the woman has her dreads piled up high, but hanging from them like a Christmas tree ornament is a Ku Klux Klan image, like a little Ku Klux Klan doll. What is that?
That's more so of a symbolization piece in terms of, like, you embracing yourself can, like, eliminate hatred, because a lot of the environment that a lot of women grow up in America and around the world, it kind of leads them to believe that, you know, if you embrace yourself, then the hatred of, you know, black hair and, you know, seeing it in its natural state. But if you embrace it, you can kill that hatred. You can eliminate it. So that was more so of a symbolization piece in terms of that. Mm.
That's artist Watson Meir. Again, you've got to go to hearnow.org to see more of his work. Watson, thank you so much.
No, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Amazon today named 20 cities as finalists in the running to host its new headquarters, from Los Angeles to Austin to Chicago to Boston. And now get ready for the Apple sweepstakes. The company says it is going to open a second campus, part of a big announcement that also had the news that Apple will bring a large amount of the $250 billion it has kept overseas back into the U.S. following the passage of the tax overhaul. The company will pay $38 billion in taxes on that money. Apple also announced it's creating thousands of new jobs and offering employee bonuses. Yesterday, Rebecca Jarvis of ABC News asked Apple CEO Tim Cook about the changes.
There are large parts of this that are a result of the tax reform, and there's large parts of this that we would have done in any situation.
So it sounds like President Trump's tax bill has been a huge windfall for Apple.
Well, there are two parts of tax bill, right? There's a corporate piece and an individual piece. I do believe the corporate tax side will result in job creation and a faster growing economy.
Joining us now is Ben Johnson. He covers tech for Here and Now and is the host of the new podcast, Endless Thread. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with Apple bringing back that money. We've been talking about this for years, that Apple is storing so many billions of dollars overseas. How significant is it that they are going to bring that money back to the U.S.?
It is a big deal, and it's a lot of money. As per usual with these things, it'll probably be made into more of a big deal by Apple and others that support the move. And it gives the company some cover to give a bunch of money back to shareholders, which it might otherwise get some heat for. But it is a game changer. Well, the question of whether it's a game changer for the U.S. economy and a bunch of like regular people, I would put a TBD on that.
Okay. And the other thing that they've announced is that they're going to give out $2,500 bonuses to employees. Now, a lot of companies have come out after the tax cut was passed and said they're going to give $1,000. I haven't heard of any doing $2,500.
Yeah, that's I think the highest I've seen as well. A lot of companies are handing out bonuses now that the bill has become law. American Airlines is giving employees $1,000. So is Bank of America. A bonus like this is a big deal for a middle-class employee. But remember, these are just bonuses, right? They're not raises. It's a one-time payout. And in Bank of America's case, for instance, it's getting several billion dollars from the tax changes. It's spending a fraction of that to give bonuses to employees.
What about the plans for a new campus? This, of course, reminds everybody of what Amazon did, although this one, it's not like they went out and asked for bids in the same way.
Right. That's true. And we don't know a lot about it yet, in part because of that. We have a few numbers. The second HQ would employ about 20,000 workers in comparison to the 14,000 at the brand new campus Apple just opened in Cupertino. What will those workers do? Unclear yet. The company says it'll start by having a lot of customer service support at its new campus. This will all happen over the next 5 years, by the way. It's part of this $350 billion commitment the company is making to the U.S. economy.
Why do they want to do this now?
Well, Jeremy, why does any tech giant do stuff like this? PR and taxes, right? We know about the new tax law passed in Congress. It has a provision that allows large companies like Apple to bring offshore money back to the U.S. With a kind of one-time low tax rate. Apple has, as we mentioned, a lot of money overseas, about $250 billion. The short-term lower tax rate is 15.5%. Carry the one. We're talking about $38 billion that the company will pay in taxes, which might have been closer to $88 billion, actually, if it didn't take advantage of this. So it's lower than it might otherwise be, and that's good for the company. But it's also about, you know, looking good, looking like the company is really, really contributing to the U.S. economy, which it will. It's bringing jobs back. It's investing in the U.S., stuff like that.
And they've already allowed Amazon to narrow down all of the cities that you might want to put your second headquarters in. Do you think that it's going to be the same group of cities that are considered for Apple's second campus?
That's a great question. I think these two searches are going to be different, even though they look similar on paper in some ways. Remember, Apple primarily wants to sell you computers. Amazon wants to sell you everything. That means we're likely talking about different kinds of workers. Part of Apple's expansion in the U.S. will be about customer service in the short term. As we said, maybe building out some of its other services in the longer term. Think iCloud, Apple Music, and the ever-present App Store. Amazon's new HQ2 will presumably employ a bunch of people from Amazon services to fulfillment, to running its massive online retail operations. But it may be that Apple will end up hiring more highly skilled workers where Amazon will have more of a mix.
Do you expect other companies to do this same thing? This is now the second big one. We haven't heard about Google trying to figure out where to put another headquarters, although Google's already got pretty big locations, especially in New York.
Yeah. Google is more built out if we're talking about tech companies, and Microsoft as well. So I don't know if we expect to see more like that.
That's Ben Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now, is the host of the new podcast, Endless Thread. Ben, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.